It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, am I right or am I wrong? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we are going to be continuing our conversation on moral bioenhancements. This is going to be part two of a two-part series. So if you haven't heard the first episode, you should go back, listen to that one first so you know what we're talking about in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And without further ado, here begins episode the second.
So the whole concept of moral bioenhancement has lots and lots and lots of problems, some of which we've kind of touched on, either through our tone or content so far.
Yeah. And I want to give a shout out real quick to a really great review of the literature on moral bioenhancements that I was reading by Jonas Specker and colleagues called The Ethical Desirability of Moral Bioenhancement, A Review of Reasons. and a lot of the things that I'm saying are things that that Specker and her colleagues pulled together from just tons and tons and tons of amazing thinkers on the subject. So just wanted to put that out there. Go read that paper if you'd like a very, very thorough breakdown. But big problems.
Yeah.
Who decides what's moral?
That's a big one. Yeah. Who's the moral authority?
I don't feel like I'm qualified.
Well, I mean, I'll step up.
So I understand that is a concern, but I also think that this is the same problem we already face in our moral decision making today. So you've got to make moral decisions in your life, and you're either trying to think through ethical reasoning yourself and consider consequences and trying to make moral decisions on your own, or maybe in a lot of cases you're sort of offloading some of that thinking to people you would consider a moral authority.
Sure, like a religion that you ascribe to. Is ascribe a word? Let's say it is.
Yes.
Or like the theory of objectivism, like some kind of theory like that.
Sure. Or even just to a person. I mean, there are people who live among us that we often think of as kind of moral geniuses.
Mr. Rogers would have been a moral authority.
Sure.
Yeah. You look at somebody and say, I think that person knows what's up when it comes to how we should act, and I'll follow their lead because it sounds like they know what they're talking about. So we already do this. We either make moral decisions on our own or we defer to a moral authority. So we're already faced with the problem of who decides what is and isn't moral.
Right.
This would just be adding on another step to that. Do you also have a device or therapy further guiding you toward that conclusion?
Yeah. And right now, even if you have an authority who is proclaiming what is and isn't moral, every individual has the freedom to agree or disagree with that and to act upon that in whatever way he or she sees fit.
Mm-hmm. So, though in some cases there might be like consequences.
Sure.
If there are like laws.
Absolutely.
Something.
There could be very severe consequences, and that would probably prevent the vast majority of people from acting out on those thoughts even if they held them, right?
Yeah.
Some people might still act out on them and then suffer those consequences. That history is filled with those stories. Every story that involves the word martyr probably has some element of that in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you might agree with the person who is labeled as martyr. In some cases, you might not. But in either case, it's someone whose stance is very different from that of the authority figure.
Mm-hmm.
The case with moral bioenhancements is you would have no choice but to agree with whatever the authority figure had determined as moral, because the bioenhancement is mandating that.
Is making that decision for you.
Right.
Well, so that's a different question entirely than I would say, because there we're talking about whether we could or should force other people to undergo moral enhancement.
Is that not inherently immoral?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, so I was considering people who would willingly choose to undergo a moral enhancement.
Whereas,
so imagine you could elect for a free surgery that would make you a better person. Would you do it?
I think the problem is that the people who would elect for that are the ones that we least need to undergo the procedure.
Well, we could all be better. I mean, I think a lot of us – we're familiar with this. We wish we were better people in a way. I know wish I was
sure,
a better person.
Sure,
there are times when I think about how I could be a better guy than I am.
Yeah,
I think,
I'm like, oh man, like I let my friends down and like I wish that I hadn't done that.
I agree with that. But I think the people that when you start talking about moral bioenhancements and you start envisioning the sort of problems that it's meant to correct, the people who are perhaps the most accountable for said problems seem to be the least likely to elect to undergo a procedure.
Right. They might say, I don't have a problem. I'm fine how I am.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone else has the problem. I'm sitting pretty. I'm like, well, the reason you're sitting pretty is because of the oppression you are dealing out to everyone else. I would argue, I don't think moral bioenhancements being mandated, being a compelled thing, everyone has to have it. I don't think that's a great idea. However, I think that's the only way it would work. Like, I don't think moral bioenhancements are a good idea, generally speaking, in that I think there are too many problems that outweigh the benefits. And the benefits only exist if it works the way we want it to work, as opposed to some perversion of that vision.
Well, I feel like we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here then, because we should talk more about what these problems are.
Sure. One we've kind of identified. The idea that you have to follow a moral authority's vision of what is and isn't moral.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that your own view of morality doesn't match up to that person's morality. Mm-hmm. It may be that morality, our sense of morality, changes over time.
The theories like relativism say that morality is an inherently personal thing, that my morality cannot be your morality, Joe, and that, that neither of our morality is going to be Noel's or Jonathan's.
And on
a society wide thing, that's definitely a question. You've also got moral pluralism, which says that, that some aspects of morality are going to counter themselves. That if you're acting completely morally in one way, it's a trolley problem, essentially.
Right.
That you're never, because of the way that the world works, you're never going to make a perfect decision.
Right. There's not a black and white binary world out there where everything is either moral or not moral. There are issues where you might be faced with a complicated problem that has no good solution.
Right.
But you still have to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes problematic in a world where you say, well, we've got a procedure that's going to force people to act in a quote unquote moral way, because that means someone has to make that. Either someone has to make that decision ahead of time about what is the moral outcome of those decisions, or whatever guiding factors push you to one choice over another.
Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, you've got the problem of what if our ideas about morality change over time? Because they do, continually. I'm positive that what was considered good and moral 600 years ago is not the exact same thing that we consider today, and that's a long term kind of concept. But
uh-huh.
Like, if these changes, if these treatments are irreversible, then who makes the decision to start changing them down the line as needed?
Well, I mean, yes, I think that's an interesting thing to consider, but I also think that sort of falls into the same thing I was talking about earlier, where this is already a problem we're faced with just having moral brains. So we have moral faculties that are informed by our sort of natural predispositions of whatever genetic element there is, and then also by our education and socialization, which happen at certain periods in time. We get sort of moral rules implanted in us. You can see this in changes between generations, where the older generation has been taught a certain thing about what's moral, and then, you know, their kids might not agree with them about
mm-hmm.
that. So in a way, I'd say this is also already a thing that we face. We're talking again just about adding coercion
well,
to it.
Well, except that I would argue a person can also come to the conclusion, like they can change their view.
They can
view.
Come to a new conclusion. Mm-hmm.
Right. They can
yeah.
change their view
but
on
of
what
course,
is and isn't moral.
So could a bioenhancement. Depending
upon
therapy,
the implementation,
yeah.
And depending upon the desires of whomever, whatever entity is actually administering them,
mm-hmm.
right? So it gets more complicated. It's not like it's something that would be decided on an individual basis, or at least not the individual who's actually having the experience. It would be decided upon from an authoritative perspective.
Right. So could you have the country vote on
well, no, because you
on
already
what
have
everybody's brain should be forced to think.
You mean
that's
before
pretty
the bioenhancements are.
Right.
Because once the bioenhancements are in, then you have the question. It's almost like our discussion on e-voting. How do you know that the true desires of the person are being reflected in
yeah.
the outcome?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's another problem. This is hypothetical.
Yeah. Would it actually be possible? We sort of talked about this earlier, but mm-hmm. I think, is it possible from a technological point of view to have something like this? And I think the answer could be both yes and no, as in we know there's a brain basis for morality that you can tamper with it with electrodes or drugs or things like that. But morality also appears to be this complex cross-brain region phenomenon, meaning we can't yet foresee a way to control outcomes with precision.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, could we ever do that?
Mm-hmm.
For example, with serotonin is not just a let's all chill out brain chemical. It also has a hand in how we sleep, our memory encoding and recall, our sexual behavior and performance, how we process pain, our appetite, how we process visual information. It has a hand in all of these. And so just like tossing SSRIs at the entire population wouldn't really be moral.
It's a nuke it from orbit kind of option.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, and
it's really too bad that we aren't like the Krusty doll in that Treehouse of Horrors. Oh, here's the problem. Someone switched this doll to evil.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. but see, that brings up another thing that we'll talk about in a minute. what is the Krusty doll's life like after he gets switched to nice?
Right.
It's not good, is it?
Nope.
No, he lives a life of humble subservience.
Yep, yep.
But anyway, so we'll get to that in a minute. But another practical problem I want to point out is, okay, so we've got this problem with precision in the brain. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly where to put the microelectrodes to make you stop kicking small children.
Sure. I hope they never do.
So we could study this to try to figure it out, but scientific ethics make it difficult to conduct experiments like this because so imagine you're trying to get institutional approval to perform brain surgery or introduce psychoactive drug regimens on people in order to see what makes them spend less time leaving jerky YouTube comments. That just seems like you're going to run into experimental ethics problems there.
That's what college students are for. And just elect to go and be a subject in one of those testing procedures, and they get like $20 at the end of it, and everything's fine.
Or even if you took a population of criminals, of people who had murdered people, you would still have a really hard time, rightfully so, getting permission from any kind of good board of humans to carry out these kinds of experiments, because any time that you do something to someone against their will when they technically do not have a disease. Like a lack of moral virtue is not a disease.
Yeah, this is another problem, because then you're going to have a conflict between the ethics of the experiment and scientific rigor, because ideally what you'd want is a randomized sample to do your experiments on. You'd have a big problem if in order to do this most ethically, we'd have to have people who volunteered to want to be a part of this experiment. But that would introduce a self-selection bias into the sample of people you're performing it on, which is going to change the outcome. So there's all kinds of trouble in trying to do experiments on this.
And bringing up the issue of, who do you perform these experiments on? It's not just an academic question. I mean, history is filled with examples of some very ethically questionable, if not downright unethical, experimental projects that subjected people without their knowledge to pretty intense and extreme experiments, in the name of science and justified in some way or another at the time. But from today's perspective, from our moral perspective today, we would say, yeah, that is all kinds of wrong. Mm-hmm. So it is a very tricky subject.
Another complication I want to introduce: what if moral cognition isn't as local as it once looked? Or what if there is no such thing as moral cognition? I'm not going to go into the whole argument, but there's another paper in Social Neuroscience from 2012 called "Where in the Brain is Morality? Everywhere and Maybe Nowhere" by Leanne Young and James Dungan.
They answer the question in the title. You don't even have to read the rest of the paper.
Essentially, they ask the questions of, is there really a uniquely moral part of the brain?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this just a label we're applying to aspects of the emotional brain and the social brain?
Mm.
And so they look for it and they say, yeah, there are some regions that have been implicated, like some of the stuff we talked about earlier, I think ventromedial prefrontal cortex and stuff like that. But it's also just a very complicated picture, and nobody's identified this moral brain substrate. There's nothing there. There may be some folly in our approach here if we're looking for where is the moral brain. There might not be a moral brain. Morality might be more like an emergent behavioral phenomenon that we're describing that comes from some emotions and some social tendencies.
Sure. And we don't if in fact that turns out to be the case, that makes it even more complicated to come up with a moral bioenhancement that would actually be effective.
Right, because then what you'd actually have to be modifying is you can't pinpoint morality in the brain. You'd have to be modifying emotions in the brain.
And now you're if you weren't already getting people a little squicky about the idea of tweaking morality, tweaking emotions, then you're thinking, wow, it sounds like you know, you're creating just a little dial on me that has a very narrow spectrum of the human experience, and everything else is off limits.
Yeah. And this actually, I would say that this conundrum is something we might expect from what we've already seen with the overlap between moral behavior and like SSRIs, which mm-hmm. do mess with emotions. Mm-hmm. So here's one more complication I want to introduce technologically: the plastic and adaptive adult brain.
Yeah.
This is a thing we've discovered, is that the adult brain is more adaptable than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And there,
which is wonderful.
Yeah. So there are examples of the adult brain adapting to problems. Forms of neural injury can, for example, be offset by ad hoc adaptations using the rest of the brain. One example is people with memory loss coming up with cognitive strategies to offset memory deficit.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you work in a really small office and everyone has a very specific job and someone has to call out sick at the last minute, and then everyone else has to figure out how can we continue to do our work plus carry the load of this person who is not there, mm-hmm. even though they specialize in something that we do not ourselves typically handle.
Right, and you might not be able to exactly cover that person's duties, but you can sort of do it.
Yes.
And another one would be sense loss. People who have lost one sense, like sight, can sometimes compensate with adapted cognition based on different senses.
Mm-hmm.
Daredevil.
Right. I was just going to say the same thing, but I decided I've been too geeky for this episode, so I held back.
But here's the question I thought about. What if we apply this to moral bioenhancement? So you go in and you do the positive equivalent of applying a brain lesion that introduces modified sociopathy. You put in some kind of modification that makes people very nice to each other. Other parts of your brain are still going to want to be selfish. So what if your brain adapts to the change mm-hmm. and finds a way to circumvent it and revert to baseline jerkiness?
Yeah, life finds a way.
Right. In this
or
case,
jerkiness.
Jerk faces find a way.
Find a way.
Yeah, so in this case, it's not that even the person in question is making a conscious effort to be selfish. It's the brain itself is adapting to these changes mm-hmm. and saying, this is not the way things are supposed to work. So other parts of the brain start behaving in a slightly different way in order to kind of get us close to that previous condition before moral bioenhancement as you possibly can get.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the other arguments that I saw was should we really be just concentrating on treating actual mental disorders before we go like whole hog on something that isn't a disorder, like moral disorders?
Right. And my response to this is that the problem with that line of questioning is it starts to argue for a zero-sum kind of perspective on the subject, saying that if you focus on one, you cannot by necessity focus on another. And my argument would be that you could certainly have these areas of research all working, perhaps even in parallel, cooperatively with one another. But it is a good question. If you could say like, well, we have some very real problems that we do not understand how to tackle in a way that is beyond just treating some symptoms. Why are we worried about something for people who have quote unquote healthy brains? Shouldn't we focus on the people who are really struggling with these diseases, injuries, disorders, and worry about that first?
Jonathan, I think I agree with your first criticism. I mean, I am wary of this type of question in general. That's just like, well, what about, the whataboutism of like,
mm-hmm.
There's another problem though.
Yeah.
So
it's like, it doesn't remove the first problem.
Yeah,
right? But
exactly.
Both problems can exist at the same time.
Yeah. Totally. So I think that this is a good question if you can point to factors that make it clear that we really are going to need to choose between one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't point to factors that make it clear that it's one or the other, then I don't think this question necessarily matters.
Holds water, yeah.
Well, how about another one then?
Sure. Okay, in a world where some people are artificially moral, would the regular people take advantage of them?
Yes, I think so.
Absolutely. If you know that every time you come by your neighbor's house and say, hey, can I borrow $20, they're going to say yes, there are going to be a lot of people banging on that neighbor's door until that neighbor doesn't have any $20 bills left.
Which brings us back to something that we covered earlier in the show, where could regular people be allowed to exist,
right,
in a world where anyone has this altruistic treatment?
So we wouldn't just be getting rid of murderers. We'd be getting rid of people who just, you know, want to have basic non-harmful pleasure-driven lives.
Right, yeah. Let's say we've got someone
middle class hedonism.
Even hedonism. We don't even need the hedonism part, but sure. Let's make a hypothetical person, and this person leads a typical life. They've got work. They've got some outside interests. More or less, they keep to themselves. They don't really socialize with their neighbors. They don't know their neighbors' names or anything. They're not mean to their neighbors. They aren't thoughtless toward them, but they don't go out of their way to know them either.
Sure. But they really love spawn camping in an online shooter game.
Sure.
It's just how they release their tension.
Yeah, right. It's a legitimate strategy, I'll remind you. But so they will take advantage of something that is not explicitly against the rules. Mm-hmm. So therefore they're not really doing anything wrong, although their pleasure is coming at the expense of other people's enjoyment. Or even if you want to take that away, let's just say that they happen to notice that a neighbor is having a hard time for whatever reason, but they don't feel any need to help. Mm-hmm. They're not making it worse. They're not judging the neighbor. They're just not helping. You could argue, well, this approach would mean that people would feel better about going out and helping others. It's not even that they are taking advantage of other people. Mm-hmm. It's that they are not ignoring them. They're mm-hmm. not discounting someone else's misfortune.
Or doing something like in the spawn camping example that's earnestly harmless, like
right.
In the grand scheme of the universe.
Right. It is irritating as all get out. I say it's a legitimate strategy. That's merely a quote from a video series. I don't actually spawn camp.
Well, I want to introduce a modification on this.
Okay.
That a lot of – I think a lot of actually very destructive behavior in the world, and I'm sure y'all would probably agree, is not even – explicitly criminal behavior,
mm-hmm.
not like violent behavior. For example, there are systemically destructive phenomena in the world in which many people participate, but nobody personally breaks a law or does anything violent to anybody else. One example I think might be some practices on Wall Street.
Sure.
That you could point to that's, okay, so you have thousands of people who collectively participate in a system that you could probably predict is going to lead to a bubble that's going to burst, that's going to massively devalue national, probably global economy, lead to millions of people being out of work. You know, so there's a system that is pretty much guaranteed to cause misery. People are participating in the system without breaking any laws.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you do about this? I mean, this in one way is regular behavior. It's not necessarily deviant. They're not, you know, beating people up in the street, not breaking any laws. What would you think about this kind of thing? What if you're just part of a system that has perverse outcomes?
Well, and this goes back to those arguments the philosophers were making at the top of the show, right? The idea that we focus so much on short-term as opposed to long-term, they would argue using moral bioenhancements, you would start to think more in long-term and that you could still have that system in place. You could completely have an investment system in place, but that the behaviors of everyone involved would be more about trying to invest and go for a long-term mm-hmm. return on that investment.
Sure. Or to take it back to the online shooter example, if you know, you could potentially argue that someone who has been spawn camped just one too many times develops some kind of heart problem, and eventually that type of repetitive emotional stress leads to a heart attack.
Yeah, that's a fair.
It's I'm not sure fair is the right word for it, but thank you. But
I've absorbed so many bullets in Overwatch. I'm just ready for someone to feel my pain.
But that same kind of drop in the ocean sort of behavior mm-hmm. that you could make an argument for in many different types of situations, I think could certainly be applied that it is that we need a mandatory universal moral upgrade.
On the flip side of that, though, is there any evidence to suggest that selfish behavior can sometimes be of benefit to a species?
Let's talk to Ayn Rand.
Hey, I mean, let's go back to the Wall Street analogy.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think it's quite easy to see how if you look at what has happened in various depressions and in financial markets throughout history.
Right.
It's obvious how certain behaviors in financial markets and on Wall Street can lead to pain and suffering around the world.
Sure. Every single major bubble burst, you would argue, you just look at the outcome of that once the bubble bursts and you think, wow, how could we have let this happen?
But then you'll also get plenty of defenders who say, look, sometimes things go wrong, but this is what drives our economy. We've got investment and even maybe sort of risky investment. It generates tons of wealth. It creates jobs. And if there is something to what people like that are saying, and this isn't the only case where it would apply, you could say that, okay, sometimes people might engage in risky, selfish behavior that could cause harm to others, and you might look at it as morally dubious, but it also has lots of positive outcomes that we depend on.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to another question. Could we nice our society to death? and allow me to bring in an animal tale about this one. Okay.
And yet not a fable.
Not a fable. No, because this is literal actual biology that's going on out there in the world. So some spiders actually live in colonies. I'm sorry to break it to you. Most spiders don't because they're cannibals. But spider cities of up to 10,000 spiders live together in some parts of the world, hanging out, not eating each other, taking care of each other's eggs, making repairs to the entire web, and sharing their food. But in this specific type of spider, every generation that they go through, about 21% of the colonies just die out, just go completely extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And so these researchers from the University of British Columbia looked into it recently, and they discovered that once the colonies reach a certain size, they essentially share themselves to starvation because the overall web isn't catching enough food to support the entire colony, and they overshare and they all die.
Huh.
Yep.
Yeah. So there we have an argument saying if we get all – if everyone's on the same page, we eventually just
– it's a Malthusian collapse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We everyone ultimately goes extinct because we weren't – cold and callous enough to let parts of us go extinct.
Yeah.
Well, here's another thing. Think about who are some of the greatest political leaders in history. Just think of some in your head here. You don't have to say who they are. I bet whoever you've got in mind had to do some really immoral stuff
in
order to achieve goals that ultimately that we now look back on and say, I'm glad that happened.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Whoever it is, a lot of people might pick Abraham Lincoln, but it's not like Abraham Lincoln just governed with a squeaky clean, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Or whoever you want to pick, leaders tend to have to do some crappy stuff.
Yeah.
So even the really good ones.
Even if it's not a conscious effort to do something crappy, it may be that they have to do something crappy in order to avoid an even more crappy consequence.
Exactly. So would we be hamstringing ourselves and sort of preventing greatness and preventing change if we say, well, everybody's always got to be a super goody two-shoes all the time? What if sometimes we need people who tread into immoral waters in order to ultimately take us to a better place?
And then there's the question that's asked in A Clockwork Orange, which is if you remove a person's ability to make an immoral choice, are they no longer a person? If
Or do moral choices matter?
But Clockwork Orange is kind of tricky too, right? Like the American version that was published without the 21st chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So chapters 1 through 20, you have Alex, the sociopathic character, who does unspeakably awful things. He is not a redeemable character at all through the vast majority of the novel, which is why I think American editors demanded the 21st chapter be left off. Spoiler alert, he gets redeemed in the 21st chapter. So for 20 chapters, he's a terrible person. Even after he's undergone the Ludovico treatment, which gives him this aversion therapy where he feels physically ill every time he wants to perform an act of violence.
He still wants to do the ultra-violence.
Yeah,
he just can't enjoy it.
Yeah, he can't think about it because it makes him sick, but he still has the desire to do it. He has not changed as a person.
Uh-huh.
He only changes in that 21st chapter as a result of maturing, of growing up. So some people have argued that Burgess's approach to that form of morality was a little short-sighted, like a little naive and optimistic, saying that you'll just grow out of being a sociopath and then you'll be fine. And people said that the way that the book ends on chapter 20, where he is quote-unquote cured of the Ludovico treatment, it no longer affects him, so he can go back to the person he was at the beginning of the novel, that raises a very tough question for the audience. Is it better to remove the ability to make these terrible decisions and have a quote-unquote peaceful society, or is it better to allow people to retain their humanity, but the consequence is you've got this unease and unrest and chaos in society? And Burgess's answer eventually was, if you wait around long enough, people grow up and then they stop being total jerk faces.
Well, you know, some people do grow up. Some people grow out of certain types of behaviors. I think just rampaging around murdering people all the time doesn't sound like something people usually grow out of.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure.
To be fair, most people who do that behavior don't necessarily get started.
They don't get the chance to continue all that long.
Well, they also don't necessarily get started at age 13.
Yeah.
Most of them tend to be – if you look at the grand scheme of criminal psychology, it tends to be later in life. But at any – the point
hence
being –
fiction
that,
versus reality.
Right.
Yeah. But it is a really interesting moral question of whether or not our personal choices and morality are part of what make us human,
right,
and whether we would be removing an integral part of the human experience by implementing some kind of treatment like this.
Would we just become some kind of fleshy robot if we were unable? You know, a robot's, at least in theory, only able to act within the parameters of its programming.
Yeah.
So would we just become robots? Because we would have the equivalent of programming. It would just be, here's a list of things you are not allowed to do, and not just from laws, you physically cannot do them because of these enhancements.
So here's the thing. I don't know if we – maybe we have, but I don't know if we've talked yet in this episode about what is the internal experience of this like. We've talked about sort of the external behavioral outcomes of
right.
it, but what does it feel like to have one of these – modifications performed to your brain.
And since it's hypothetical, it's really
exactly,
imagine.
I'm just saying, trying to imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be a case where you really want to do something immoral and you feel the urge to do it, but something prevents you?
Right. Like your cybernetic
it's
implant.
It's like you can't get it out.
Your cybernetic implant makes sure that you can't, you know, go outside and kick that kid that's been irritating you all day. It's not that you don't want to do it. It's that you physically are unable to do it. Or
does it change your fundamental desires?
Right.
Right.
And that seems harder to imagine. In that case, would you still be you?
Right. And you could argue that if it was something that was done from birth, then it is you. It's it's not the you could have been, right?
Yeah.
It's you as mandated.
Well, and I think that based on the neurobiological view of what we currently know about how we could implement this kind of treatment, I think that's more likely actually that latter thing where just our very personalities would be different more than having like a button in your brain that like prevents the kicking mechanism
right.
from traveling through your nervous system.
Well, right? I mean, I guess here's one thing we could compare it to. Imagine you're somebody who takes an SSRI for depression or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How does that change you? Do you like feel depression coming on, but then something stops it? Or do you just is it just something that's no longer a feature of your brain in the same way?
So sort of, or like, have you guys ever had like a really bad headache and then taken some headache medication and you can tell there's still a headache, but you're not feeling the pain anymore? Because that happens with me in migraines,
mm-hmm.
where I'm aware that there is something in my brain that is not right, that it would be causing me agony, but the medication I am on prevents that pain sensation. But there's still, like, it almost feels like a presence, like mm-hmm. almost like it's a physical sure. thing in my head.
Huh. I have, if I may share this experience with y'all, taken SSRIs for anxiety and depression. And for me, the way that it's worked is, it's more like, it's sort of like I'll get an idea, an anxious or a depressive idea. And without the medication, I've sometimes had the experience of not being able to escape from the idea, kind of have that idea repeat and get worse and kind of spiral
so
in my head, fixating. Yeah, exactly. But with that kind of medication, I've had the experience of just being able to shut it off, just going like, this is ridiculous, dude. Stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And having that work, as opposed to other times when I have that thought and my brain's just like, nope, blur.
Yeah. Forget about being any sort of productive member of society. You are going to be paralyzed with self-doubt and fear.
This is just what you're doing for the rest of your day.
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been there.
And so, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's a very strange thought to try to imagine that kind of thing going over into moral territory of like, man, like, I really want to cut that dude off in traffic, but I guess I can just calm down. I guess just everything's going to be fine.
It'd be interesting to live in a world where road rage is just a term of something that used to happen, right? Like, that's a weird thought, especially here in Atlanta. So let me ask you guys a question. I think we can wrap up this discussion. It's gone on pretty long, and we had another section that I think is completely superfluous, so I cut it. But I do have a question for both of you. So, and I'll be happy to answer it too. Your own personal response to the idea of moral bioenhancement. Do you think ultimately it sounds like something that we should absolutely pursue, or do you think the negatives outweigh any positives? What was your personal feeling, Joe?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it's very complicated for all the reasons we've talked about
mm-hmm.
here and probably some other ones we haven't even thought of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think that I think there's a tendency that a lot of us who have experienced dystopian science fiction have
mm-hmm.
to want to say anything that sounds kind of creepy is something that is ultimately like, no, that, you know, we shouldn't even look there. And I don't feel like that. I don't feel like this is something we shouldn't even look into. But I'm certainly not ready to commit to moral bioenhancement, especially not compulsory moral bioenhancement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, voluntary moral bioenhancement. That I'm trying to think of what exactly would be the problem with that, and nothing's coming to mind.
It's hard to say without the actual ability to do it, right?
Because
we can't observe the results.
Yeah, I think the only real risk is having those people being taken advantage of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that compulsory is would be flat out evil. Just that would be completely immoral. I'm taking a stance right there.
Okay.
And I don't know. Like, I think actually allowing the possibility of voluntary moral bioenhancement might range towards evil a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
I feel pretty strongly and kind of surprisingly like I'm kind of pro a lot of other voluntary brain enhancements. But this one, I don't know. I have real squeaky feelings about.
Okay. Well, let me test you on that a little
sure.
bit, if that's all right.
Yeah, totally.
All right. So we have a serial killer
okay.
who has been caught by police. And this is a guy who's murdered 27 people. He tells the police that he will not stop. If he is set free, he will do it again. Now, this guy has several options. He can go to prison for the rest of his life,
mm-hmm.
or he can elect to take some proven bioenhancement therapy, and we'll just assume optimal conditions here. We've actually shown that it works in some way.
There's not a danger of this somehow going wrong.
Right. And so we could put him in prison the rest of his life, or we could give him this thing and release him, and he could live out his days and never harm anyone again. Do you still think that, like,
if it, in a perfect world where the treatment was not a lobotomy and not the kind of aggressive drug therapy that has sometimes been practiced, then yes, if the treatment truly was changing just his desire to go kill a whole bunch of people, mm-hmm. then of course that would be beautiful.
But that's a big if.
But that's a big if. That's such a hypothetical thing, and I don't personally envision us figuring out enough about the brain and enough about ourselves to do that, certainly in our lifetimes, maybe ever.
Yeah.
Is that too cynical? I like to think that we're capable of everything.
Except for the fact that human beings also change over time. So mm-hmm. as we gain an understanding of how things are, we don't necessarily have an understanding of how things will be.
Sure.
So that's another, I mean, you would think that our scientific understanding would start to outpace other factors, because it's not like evolution happens super fast, but that is still a factor. Lauren, I side with you mainly on this. I mean, Clockwork Orange is one of my favorite novels of all time, and it's largely because I read the American edition that left off that 21st chapter, which to me makes it the reader's responsibility to answer the question, which is the greater evil, right? Mm-hmm. Which of these things that come out are the greater evil? The allowing people who have immoral thoughts and who act upon them to exist, or removing the ability for a person to make any choice other than the ones that have been mandated by an authority figure, even if that's a range of behaviors, is that better? And more often than not, I side with that you shouldn't mess with that, at least not too much. I do think, to Joe, your point, the idea of pursuing it in a way that is a treatment for pathological issues makes sense in that it's treating a person who otherwise doesn't have that capability. It's literally a pathological issue, whether it's from an injury or an illness, condition, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. And it's a danger to yourself or others kind of situation.
Yes. That kind of situation, I would say that makes sense. I think anything beyond that is at best problematic. I've also seen some criticisms. I didn't go into it in the notes because I didn't have time to really read and digest all the information. But I've seen critics of the idea of moral bioenhancement say, just based upon the way we have scientific progress and technical progress alone, would suggest that we would be able to address this in a very piecemeal kind of way, which mm-hmm. could end up having disastrous consequences, where it's like the idea of having that superhuman intelligent machine and you say, hey, I want you to find a solution for world peace, and its solution is to kill everybody mm-hmm. because now there's no way you could have conflict. That kind of idea that if you were to address one part of morality without being able to affect all of it, you could have some unintended catastrophic consequences. And I think the capacity for things to go wrong is so great that it outweighs the capacity for it to be a benefit to society. That being said, I would love to see some really progressive, effective means of having people kind of come to a moral enhancement that doesn't involve bioenhancement, whether it's the education or some form of outreach, things like that, so that people have that experience and are able to expand that small social group to a larger group of people, and also expand that short-term gain perspective for a long-term one.
Yeah. Another complication on top of all of this is that in the example we gave about, you know, somebody who's been already convicted of many violent crimes, you'd also have the problem that people often don't just view prison as like preventative.
It's a punishment.
Right. And so that would also be a complication. So imagine somebody has done a bunch of very harmful evil, and now we're saying, well, what we could do with this person is give them a treatment that would mean they'd never do anything like that again. a lot of people would not be satisfied with that. They'd say, no, what needs to happen is this person must suffer in response to what they did.
It's not – this is where you start to – you know, what? How do you view the purpose of prisons? Is it meant to be a punishment? Is it meant to be a center for rehabilitation?
Mm-hmm. And the concept of the penitentiary being making someone become penitent.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's in the name. Exactly. Well, that was an amazing conversation about concepts that are pretty heavy. I appreciate that you guys took the time to have that conversation with me because, again, like, I love this whole arena of thought. It's fascinating to me. And it's one that I think about a lot. And I would argue that in a lot of ways, forward thinking, being in kind of an optimistic view of what the future might be, a lot of that optimism depends upon the concept of compassion. And if you were to argue that compassion is having a less relevant place, maybe your solution to that issue would be, hey, how about moral bioenhancements? But as we've discussed on here, we're not so convinced that would be the best approach, especially not compulsory moral bioenhancements. But I'm curious to hear what our listeners think.
Yeah, you guys, get in touch with us.
Yeah, you can send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. At Twitter, we're fwthinking. Over on Facebook, you can just search fwthinking. Our profile will pop up. Leave us a message there. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.